Welcome to the Live Courageously podcast show, episode number 80. I'm your host, John Duffy, and Live Courageously has been the conscious theme of my life for the last 3 years since the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, and an unconscious theme for most of my life. Courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear. There's something contagious about someone who is courageous. Today's show is a take two, a take three, and maybe even a take four, as our previous attempt suffered from audio tech issues and others. So we're back with a courageous and very adventurous friend, Charles Vaught. And Charles Vaught is the author of the nonfiction books, Northern Jaeger and State of Fire Boat, of which are based on his real world experiences. Vaught is also the founder and managing editor of St. Charlie's Press, an independent publisher based out of Colville, Washington, that specializes in publishing up and coming talent. Charles has traveled extensively, having spent over 4 years abroad adventuring and teaching English. Throughout his life, Vaught has gained experience as a commercial fisherman, a wildland firefighter, an ESL teacher, and a nonprofit volunteer, all of which he uses as fuel for his writing. When not writing or publishing, Charles enjoys reading, traveling, cooking, and practicing Muay Thai, a martial arts. Vaught has also two upcoming writing projects, a nonfiction book based on his misadventures in foreign lands, and a horror screenplay, which is kind of what it's been to try and get the show to go. You can follow Charles on Facebook or Instagram at Charles Vaught Author, or you can contact him directly at editor@stcharliespress.com. If you like to purchase either of his books, you can find them at stcharliespress.com or on Amazon. And with that, let me welcome Charles to the stage. Welcome.
Wow. take four.
Here we go.
Wow. It's been a long road to get here, John, but thank you so much for having me.
I mean, you know, I think we both were tested. You know, I thought I was tested back in, well, I won't say what that is, but we'll get to that in a minute. But boy, this was an intro. After 80 shows, this was like, it's supposed to get easier. It's not supposed to get harder.
Right. Oh, well, you're welcome.
Thanks a lot. But hey, you know, let's start with the two things that I always like to start with. One is, how did we know each other? Because most of the people that I've had on my show are people that I know in the real world, not sure. Just in the social media world. So yeah. How did we meet? And tell the backstory to the audience about our journey.
Yeah. So I met you, I must have been about 16 years ago, 15, 16 years ago, because I was about 29 or 30 when I took that club. So we met in Manona Wali's memoir writing class that was held at Santa Monica Community College. And it was such an amazing class. At that point in my life, I had been taking every writing course that I could, because I knew in my heart of hearts that I had to be a writer. And so I was taking fiction classes, I was taking graphic novel classes, I was taking screenplay classes, and I just happened upon a memoir writing class, because I was like, you can never have enough tools in your tool belt when it comes to writing. So I took that memoir writing class, and it just clicked. There was just the right group of people. There was about 7 or 8 of us that just, we just clicked, and everybody just kind of really just brought their best like each week to class. And then once that class ended, then Manona was so kind as to host us in her home to do a writing course in her writing group in her home. And we did that for another, gosh, at least a year and a half. And it's been a minute. It's been a journey.
It has, and it was a great class of a lot of very creative individuals, great people who brought some great stories every week. And I was always challenged, not as much as trying to get this show going, but I'd have to write, like, you know, 5 minutes before I came into class. I was like getting in the last minutes of my story to read that night in class. So it was always challenging, but everybody gave me positive, but also good critiques of what I could do to make it better. So I always enjoyed process?
Oh yeah, same. I look back very fondly on that class, and I've been in numerous writing classes and writing workshops since then. And I always just, you know, that's always like the golden years. That was always like this like golden age of writing with that core group of us that just the encouragement, the belief, the feedback, the talent, like it was just, it was awesome. Everybody took it seriously. Everybody had fun. The feedback that I got was, you know, I've been in classes where they just kind of coddle you. And it's like, that's not what you want as a writer. You want people to tell you what's wrong. I want to know what sucks, you know, what doesn't work. Don't tell me, oh, it was really good. Great.
Yeah, no. Well, you know? there was one person in that class who definitely used to tell me that all the time what sucked with my writing. And I loved it. It was always good to hear that.
That's right. That's how we get better.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the second question, and then I want to dive into this because I always ask is, since the show is Live Courageously, what does that mean to you? And you've had clearly an adventurous and at times I would call courageous life,
yeah,
going where you've gone. So tell us a little bit about your interpretation of that.
You know, being courageous means I guess living courageously to me means being my authentic self in all situations. And it's not always nice and it's not always pleasant, but doing the best I can to honor myself through what I do and to be the best man that I can be through whatever I do.
That's I think a good short summary of what it means. And, you know, one of the things that coming out of the class, and, you know, I think if I'm not wrong, out of all the people in the class, you're the first one to actually publish two memoirs, if I'm correct. Or was there somebody else who published one before us? Before you?
I think I'm the only person to publish a memoir, but I know Kira, she published at least one or two novels. I think two, possibly. At least two, maybe three novels.
Ah.
Yeah.
So you were the first one to come out with a memoir. And you know, the challenge for me is because I have one that I'm in the process of finishing. But like, this is great to have published two and then send them to me and autograph them for me. So I thank you for that. And it also, it's an encouragement for me to continue to push ahead and get to the completion, because that's kind of what it's about. You know, it's all that work is only beneficial if you get to share it with others, you know, so you can share that and share those stories. So that's kind of why we all came together. So thank you. And I appreciate the fact that, you know, I got some more motivation and encouragement by your success of getting your two out there.
Awesome. That's really great to hear. That's really great to hear. I have to give so much credit to Monona, because, you know, it's, I always find it interesting how people in life, you know, you can look back and be like, they might've just said like one thing to you, but it's almost like changed the course of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I can definitely credit that to Monona, because I remember her telling me at one point that she had spent 17 years to get her first novel to publication.
Wow.
And that was just like, I always remember that, and that always stuck in my head. And it was always like, okay, don't give up. Keep going. Don't stop. Keep going. Because though Northern Jaeger is my second memoir, it's my first memoir. My first book is just nonfiction, but whatever. It took me 14 years and 11 drafts. And with each draft and with each passing year, I always remembered what Monona said, and that always kept me going. I was like, okay, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how long it takes. As long as I'm happy with it and I think it's perfect, then I'm okay to set it out. And it took 14 years and 11 drafts to get that way.
Well, you know, that's a great testimony to her and for what she accomplished. And I have to second that. I mean, she definitely played a great role for all of us and yeah. of encouragement and that thing of never giving up. So, I mean, you know, she was a force for all of us. So that was, I think we were very lucky to end up in her class and end up in her life. So that you know, yeah. And then with you, I mean, listening to that, all those drafts and all those times, boy, I'm starting to get a little bit nervous again. But anyway, but let me, if you don't mind, and here's, let me just throw up, we'll kind of work ourselves forward and then go backwards, you know, sure. We'll do the latest one. This is the, yeah. the most recent one, Norton Jaeger. And I'd love to, if you don't mind, read the intro to your book for the audience, because I just love the intro. So if you don't mind, I'm going to do that. And just share what, you know, was written in the intro so that they hear it. Get ready to question what's on your dinner plate as Charles Bott, a broke, nerdy, loveless, hippie, wannabe turned fisherman, spills the guts, literally, of the seafood industry on commercial fishing ships, the Norton Jaeger. Join him as he ventures wildly out of his depth, leaving his comfortable life in rural Washington and climbing aboard his mistress of the sea with 100 tough and hardened career fishermen in search of fortune and glory on the Bering Sea. From backbreaking labor and gleeful fish slaughter to getting caught with his pants down, I don't want to go there, weathering violent storms and learning the ropes of his new role as a viscera technician. That's a word. Bott's memoir is a hilarious and eye-opening journey through the commercial fishing industry in the year 2000. Discover the shocking secrets of surimi, I don't know what that is, survive a fully functioning sea factory, and discover why you should probably think twice about that seafood dinner. So much more than a memoir, Bott's wit makes Norton Jaeger a gut-busting adventure that leaves you hooked. Wow. So that's just your, you know, intro to it. And I just say so much is packed into that boat. Grittiness, language, just realness, all that is just packed into that thing and it's packed into your memoir. So take it from there and take us on, let's go on that journey on the Norton Jaeger.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, in the year 2000, actually I was back in 1999 is when the journey to the Jaeger started. And, you know, a friend of mine that I'd known before from Seattle, from working in Seattle, she was road tripping through Washington State, came through my hometown, and just sort of sold me and my best friend on this idea of working on a fishing ship in Alaska. And I had never, that thought had never even crossed my mind. That was the farthest thing from my scope of possibility. And you know, she sold us on this idea, and it just sounded like this, like just a fantastic adventure. And you know, it just conjured up thoughts of like money and the high seas, and just like, wow, these are I money and adventure have always been kind of driving factors in my life. And that was like my first taste of it. And it was amazing. And going on that, you know, just going on that ship and experiencing all the crew and the work and the ship life and just the politics of things that worked behind the scenes, and then seeing how the fishing industry worked. And it just was such a formative time in my life, and it just had such a deep impact on me. And I've had people ask me, like, wow, how did you must have like kept a journal and like really just like, you know, very detailed journal. And I was like, I didn't actually. I just have a really, really, really good memory, and I'm able to recall things. And so that's why I was able to just pack it with so much detail and pack it with so much realness, because that's just how it was. That's where I was. That's who I was at the time. Like one of the things that was really important for me, and that's why it took so long to get it right, was that I really wanted it. I had to take a step back in time to my 21-year-old self and write it from my 21-year-old point of view, because I was 21 at the time. I'm 45 now. And so clearly you evolve through life, or you should, and I have. And so I had to take a step back and be like, okay, what was important to me at that time in life? What did I care about? Who was I? And then kind of step into those shoes, and then write from that perspective. And it was so much fun to write. Like, despite all the passage of time, despite all the drafts, I had a blast writing it. I had so much fun writing the book that, and by the way, I like to write the way that I like to read. So I really try not to write things that are boring. I like exciting prose. I like to just put people like in my skin so they can see and feel what I'm going through. And it's something that I'm very proud of. And it's like I said, it might have taken 14 years and 11 drafts to get to where it is now, but I could not be happier with the final result. And I've been getting excellent feedback from people. And I mean, I've had one person even tell me, wow, this was like, it's so like cinematic. You should turn this into a screenplay and make a film out of it. I'm like, yeah. One step at a time.
Yeah, I've had those. Yeah, I agree. One step at a time, you know. But you've taken it out there. And this, for example, is a book launch signing that you did just recently for the book. That's up in Washington, correct?
Correct. Yeah, I launched the book on June 24th here in Colville, Washington. And when I, with both State of Fire and with this book, I like to do, I hate to call it a reading, because I've been to quite a few book readings, and they're typically, I find them extremely boring, where you have the author up there and they're nose is buried in the book and they're quiet as a church mouse, and you're just like checking your watch going, oh my gosh, like, come on, hurry up, I just want to get my book signed and get out of here so I can read it on my own. So I try to do something different when I do these, and so I call it a passionate reenactment. So I really like to like just like bring the heat and bring the thunder and like bring theatrics to it, and like really almost memorize my passages that I'm going to read. And then, so that way I don't have to have my nose buried in the book. I can like make eye contact with the audience. I really just like, you know, I know how it's supposed to sound, because I've had it in my head for so long that I know when to punch the sentences and when to like hit and like when to pause and do dramatic pauses and string it out a little and then, bring it. And it works. I've had a lot of really good feedback from that as well. And, unfortunately with this book, I might do another reading, but I don't really want to do too many more readings. I'd rather push this book through podcasts this go around. But what I am going to do is start, I do have some tricks up my sleeve that I'll reveal later on.
Well, sounds good. But you know, once again, and I think that was a wise choice to make it more performance art, to make it more engaging, because you're right. You know, I'm a big reader. I've always been passionate about reading ever since I dropped out of high school at 15, and I just love reading. And so I've read hundreds and hundreds of books over my lifetime of all types. And you know, it's just your book has, like I said, it puts you in there, and taking it to performance makes sense. Because going back, what an adventure. I mean, you know, even in the class when you were writing, I couldn't believe, you know, because it was so outside my world. One, sure. Alaska. Two, all of a ship, fishing. What is that? I have no clue. You know, I'm living in a small, in an urban ghetto, and I'm like, I have no clue what that world's like. But you brought it to life with the language. And so here, I'm going to throw up a pick, and you, why don't you take us on that? Tell us that journey. I'm going to show some pictures as you do it.
Yeah.
This is, you know, on the front of this gigantic ship, 100 of your workers that you joined. So you get there. You're 21 years old, I believe. You walk on the ship. And what do you feel? I mean, it's like you got to have a mix of emotions.
I mean, so me and two of my best friends, we boarded the ship on January 1st, 2000. And, you know, we're a little bit hungover, and you're stepping on board this massive ship in dry dock in Seattle, and it's kind of misty rain, and it's like wintertime, and it's cold, and you're just like, wow, this is a lot bigger than I had anticipated. You hear the word ship in your mind, and you're like, okay, cool. But then you get on it, and you're like, okay, this is a vessel. This is massive. Like, I mean, it was at least, I have the dimensions in the book, but off the top of my head, I believe it's a little over 100 yards long, and it's the size of like two school buses butted up nose to nose. That's how wide it was. And it was like nothing I'd ever experienced. Nothing I'd ever, I'd never been on a ship before. I'm from, a farm town in rural Washington, where, I was raised on the side of a mountain, and to to go to this and then like be out to sea. And, and then and to start off, it was just me and my three friends and a few other crew members. And like, we were tasked with cleaning the ship before for the first 2 weeks. And so, we got to like really like explore the ship, and like, you're and one of the things that always like takes me back are the smells. Like, I can't walk through like Pike Place Market or any kind of fish market without just like being instantly like taken back to those times. But and you get to see these like all these like when you're because there's no one else on board, so we're walking through and we're seeing the diesel engines, these massive diesel engines that power the ship, and we're seeing like all these control boards with all these dials and things, and you're just like dials and gauges, and you're like, this is so crazy. And then the factory, and then like all this machinery that's like that we have no clue what any of this does. This is so far beyond us. And then going from there to having the crew board, and where I'm from in Washington State, there's not any diversity up here. There's just not. There's just there. At least back then, there's a little bit better now, but back then there just wasn't any. It was all white people, which is fine, but that is what it is. And so being on board that ship, it was just like, from all four corners of the world, people were coming to board this ship, and like different languages and different people and different cultures. And it's just like, it really was like a true melting pot, even more so than, what I lived in Los Angeles. It was just like really like, because you're integrated together in such a way that you have to interact. There is no, you don't have a choice to separate from anyone. You have to interact with everyone. So it's just, it was just amazing and fun and beautiful, and this like adventure that like it was a real life-changing experience in my life. And it and then and then we set once everybody boards, and we get all our gear on board, then we steam to Dutch Harbor, which is in the Aleutian Islands of Alaska. And then from there, it was, I mean, it's basically, as soon as we boarded, it was off to the races. Like, we didn't stop working until we got off on May 5th. Like, it was, definitely like the most work I've ever done in my life, for sure. And I've been a wildland firefighter, and that was a lot of work. So this
And
really says something.
we're gonna
It,
go there, but
sure.
I want to dive into this. So here's
Yeah,
just
yeah,
some
yeah.
pictures. This is
Oh, we're offloading right there. That's Dutch Harbor. Those are
that's after you come in and offload, correct? And then of
That,
course this
yep.
picture here where it's coming down the
Yep.
conveyor.
And those are 50-pound boxes of frozen fish, frozen product coming off the ship. Yep.
But n now let's dive in. So you get there, and like you said, all this diversity of people. But besides all the diversity of people, you and your two friends are young, just young kids, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of the crew, most of the crew, maybe if not all the crew, are seasoned, hardened
Yep.
fishermen who've done
Yep.
it many, many times. And you kind of got to maybe prove yourself, probably, and be able to get into this group. That's a pretty tight group. So there's that part. And then, of course, tell us about how easy the hours were, because you didn't work much on the ship, right?
Yeah, no, it was a real pleasure cruise. Yeah, it was fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was so it was a factory trawler. So what that means is they would launch nets, they would drag the nets, they haul the nets up, they dump the fish into live tanks, let the fish die, then the fish would be run through the factory, and through the factory they are sorted, forced for, the type of fish that we're supposed to be catching. And then from there, the fish are run through these machines via people. They're run through these machines that then slice off the fillets and gut them. Fillets go to one area. They're sorted out for defects and size. And then the guts go to another area. And then those are sorted out to get the roe from the female fish, the roe sacks. And then those, the fillets and the roe, then they're graded, weighed, boxed, frozen, and then kept in the freezer hold, which was this massive chamber in the belly of the ship. And then all the excess parts that we couldn't eat were then, or that were not edible, I suppose, were then turned into fish meal, which is fish food. And this was an operation that went on 24/7 that didn't stop. As long as we had fish, it was processing. And the goal was, as I learned the hard way, the goal was to process. You did not want downtime. You wanted to process as fast and hard and as you could, because you wanted to fill your quota so you could go home. That's the end goal, is to make money and go home. You really don't want to be out there. It's not a pleasant place. It's not fun. I mean, it's fun to an extent, but it's hard work, and it's not. The ship ran 24/7. And so, but as a crew, we would work 6 on, 6 off, 6 hours on, 6 hours off, which sounds great in theory, because you're like, oh, cool, it's only 6 hours of work. But the reality is, you have to, when you're 6 hours off, you have to eat, shower, sleep, wake up again, recaffeinate, eat, and then get back down to the factory to do your 6 hours of work. So all said and done, I was getting between probably 2 to 3 hours of sleep per 6 hour shift. So every 24 hours, I was getting between 4 and 6 hours of sleep. And it really takes a toll on you mentally, emotionally, and physically. And you're working so much that you're dreaming about working, and you're working harder in your dreams than you are in real life. And it's like, it doesn't stop. And then once the freezer hold is full, then you go to offload. And that means you're steaming to Dutch, you get to Dutch Harbor, and it's go time. And when we worked our offloads, we worked 5 hours, it was 12 hours on, 5 hours off, because the goal is to not go have a little jaunt about Dutch Harbor. The goal is to get that product off the ship as soon as possible, get back on the ship, and get back out to sea. So it was nonstop. And
period of time you work was a 4 month period, correct? 3 to 4 month period.
I was out there from, we left Seattle January 15th, and we did not return to Seattle until May 5th.
Okay. So, and besides, like you said, you didn't want any downtime, because the more you had to hit your quota, and that's what you were aiming for, and that's how you got paid, and all those things were happening. But you did have downtime. For those who don't understand, you're out in the Bering Sea in Alaska. So the water there is it's brutal at times. And so what caused the downtime? Because in your book, when you read it, when I was reading your book, the only thing I could come close to is different reality shows like Dirty Jobs, or the one about the fisherman. I can't remember the name.
Deadliest Catch. Yeah, yeah.
Those are the reality shows that came to mind. Going, oh my god, this is horrible. So
yeah. So downtime can be caused by it's when they're not catching fish. I mean, so I sometimes the schools of fish just aren't there. And or they're in different fishing waters, so we've got to steam to those. Or it's so rough that you can't process. The seas are so rough you can't process, because I mean, that happens. And where that your ship's going like this, and like this, and you're just like up and down and up and down, and product is slipping and sliding and slapping onto the floor, and it's like you just have to shut down. You just can't process when it's that nasty out. So it's you're dependent on Mother Nature for all of it, basically. And it's yeah, it's you know, but when the seas when it all comes together and everything works, it's a process.
Well, I can only not relate, but relate. On my birthday years ago, we took a Catalina Express to the island of Catalina
Oh,
in
yeah.
November. And on the way back, they had a storm. And I didn't know they could have storms because what do I know? I'm a New Yorker in California, right? So on the way back, this, small Catalina Express hit all these storms. And I think about three quarters of the people on the ship were throwing up. And it was, oh man, it was ugly. It was freaking ugly. And I'm thinking, and that's nothing compared to what the storms up in Alaska that you
Sure,
were. That's just like kindergarten compared to that. So I couldn't imagine if somebody offered me, you can go out on that ship for 4 months. Forget it. No, that's one thing I would say no to.
Well, thankfully, I have a strong stomach and I did not get seasick.
Wow.
I can't say so much for my friend Nudie, who was on the ship with me. And there was a story that like it was in one of the previous drafts, but I ended up cutting it because it didn't like further my story. It was his story, and I was like, well, this book isn't about him, it's about me. But I will tell you now, his seasickness was so bad that they like took him on deck and they had a chair out there that they strapped him to
Oh my gosh.
and just let him ride it out,
Wow.
yeah, until he
He got rid of
grew up.
everything that was in his body.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like,
To put it mildly.
yeah, exactly. So it's just it's a very different way of life. It's a very different way of
Yikes.
life.
Yikes. So, obviously you learned so much from it. I want to just throw up some quick pictures of you because all besides the hardness of it, and I wish, sometimes, in this generation you realize that people like you say in the introduction, to make you think twice about your fish dinner. But most people have no clue what it takes to provide food on their table, whether it's fish or meat or whatever, even vegetables, whatever it takes to bring food to the marketplace, and how hard people labor and who those people are and what kind of stuff they go through to make your life easy at the end point when you just go in and purchase it. So, in some ways you just wish, that everybody would just have to do 3 months of labor on the Northern Jaeger. It might be a great wake-up call for a lot of people about, what they want to complain about in life
Sure.
as opposed to maybe you won't complain about too many things in the future if you realize what it takes to get to make your life easy.
Very true. Very true. I agree. Every meal tells a story. Every morsel that you put in your mouth tells a story of someone else's endurance and labor and hardships and what they had to do to get that to your table.
Yeah. Well,
So,
there's also some fun pictures of you because obviously, not only, of course, there was the fun side and you tried to make the best of it. Here's a couple. This is a picture of you all in gear
Hey.
acting crazy on the ship, right?
Yeah, that's the viscera table
The
right
visual,
there.
that's where the fish went down, correct? And you took it.
That's where that's like the guts. So viscera is, as I found out the hard way, is like intestines. I didn't had no idea what viscera meant, but it's the like the insides, and so that's the inside of the fish. That's the gut table, the viscera table. That's where we separate. Hey, look at me, I'm eating fish guts.
So
So one of the things about being on there is that you really, in order to survive, like I really had to like just find humor in everything and kind of like go into a you get that sort of what's the right turn of the phrase? It's like a real just you have to just find like humor in everything and even in the darkest places. And so that's what we did to survive. Like mentally, that's what you have to do. Otherwise, I would have cracked. Like it was a lot. It was a lot.
It comes across the humor in the book, and I recommend everybody to read the books that book in particular, but the other one as well. And we'll get to that. But you're right. It's like in the toughest situations, what we people do to survive is humor. You find humor. You make fun of things. You make fun of each other. You make fun of the experience. Yeah. And that's your release to deal with, you know, stuff that's a little bit overwhelming and can be traumatic at times, you know, potentially. So you're dealing with it, you know, and humor is a powerful thing. And you know that with people, first responders, military people in hospitals, people who deal with tough stuff. Part of it, you always got to be able to just make fun. And it may seem like dark humor, but it's survival. It's how you get through.
Yeah. You know, you got to laugh to keep from crying.
That's right. Yeah. And I can only imagine, because being out there, boy, I'd have probably been tied next to your friend up a board. Yeah. And that would not have been any fun whatsoever. Trust me. But go back. So your adventures don't, you know, this is a venture. There's the next adventure, which, like you said, it was more stories as a little bit, as opposed to memoir. And that's from the, that's not what I wanted to show. This is it. The State of Fire.
There we go. Is
another Life Lessons Learned on the Fire Line. So that's a book that you wrote previously, and that captures another period in your life. Once again, doing a job that most people have no clue. Like, we know in California and Washington and other places, there's so much fires in certain seasons, but most people have no clue as to who are the people who go out there and fight them and make it so that they don't spread, and hopefully save lives and save the environment in doing it. So you did that. Why? How did you get into that? Because that came after the trip, right? So you come off and you didn't have enough fun, you know, being out of the
Not enough challenge in life. When I was in Alaska, I was 21, and so now cut to I'm now 34. Is it 34? I was 34. And I found myself going to college, going to university at 34. And at my my first summer break, gearing up to that in the springtime, I knew that I didn't want to work a job, like a full-time job, and try to go to school. I wanted to focus solely on school. And so in order for me to do that, I knew that I needed to find a summer gig that I could make enough money that I could then use that to pay for my schooling and living and not have to work during the year. So I could just focus on my school, because that was really important to me. And so I called up a friend of mine that he worked in the oil fields in North Dakota, and he didn't call me back. And then I called up another friend of mine who I knew was a wildland firefighter and had been for about a decade at that point, maybe a little longer. And I didn't really know what that meant. I just knew that there were forest fires and there were people that went and put them out. I had no clue the process or how it went or what was involved. And I called my friend up and told him what was going on. And he, 2 days later, I got a call from a hotshot crew in Arizona. And then I got a call from the Highlands 20 here in Washington State, which is an elite 20-man hand crew. And I went and met up with, went and did an interview with the Highlands 20, which consisted of, you know, me sitting across a picnic table from three seasoned firefighters that, you know, asked me questions like, what does respect mean to you? And you're like, you know, you're trying to come up with things at the top of your head. And then following that up with a physical challenge. Like, we had to run like a mile and a half in like 10 minutes. Was it? Yeah. I think it was about a mile and a half in 10 minutes. And then we had to do as many pull-ups as we could in a minute, as many sit-ups as we could, and as many push-ups as we could, all in, you know, a minute each. Because you have to be physically fit for this job. It's not for the weak. You have to be, first and foremost, you have to be physically strong, mentally strong. Yes, that helps, but physically strong first and foremost. And it was, I love a challenge. I love I love it. I love challenges. I love challenging myself. And I also, you know, was again, once another point in my life when I needed money. And so this was, you know, like two things I love. Yeah. This running theme of my life is adventure and money. So it's like, what's next? But, yeah, it was, they liked, you know, even though I was, cause I was, when I was on the, so I worked on the Highlands 20, which was an elite 20 man hand crew, as I like to say. And there was, so there was me and 19 other men on this crew. And the average age of a crew member was about 20, 21.
Wow.
So I'm coming in as like the old man on the crew at 34.
Wow.
And it was, and
the opposite of the Northern Jaeger where we,
yeah,
you're the young kid on the block age-wise.
Yeah. I'm still a rookie, but I'm coming in far older than everyone else.
Right.
So that means that I had to like, I couldn't slip. I couldn't like go out on these like all night drinking binges like these kids were and like just bounce back like a rubber band. Like I had to stay fit. I had to like, you know, I was getting up early and like working out before work because it was like, I have to, I don't have a choice. I gotta keep it up. I gotta maintain. And, you know, it was this shot of adrenaline and testosterone that I just needed, like, just to be around this, like all these young bucks and to like go out there. And so we were separated from the Highlands 20 have their own fire camp, which is out in Loomis, Washington, which is literally the middle of nowhere, Washington. and so, you know, we're basically 20 of us are separated from society for 3 months at a time. And that's where we live. And we're separated from everyone basically. And then we would go to different fires, wherever the fires were. And, you know, then we'd go to fires, depending on where they were, we would either stay at the fire at a fire camp there, or if they were local, we would stay at fires, you know, we would stay at our own camp. But it was, it, you know, for 100 days, for 100 days, for 3 summers in a row, you know, you work together, live together and play together. And, you know, we had a saying on the crew, there are no secrets in the Highlands 20, because you got to know everybody very well, whether you wanted to or not. like you lived together, worked together, played together, showered together. Like we had a, you know, high school locker room style showers, and there just weren't, you knew everything about everybody. And it was just the camaraderie, like that built was like nothing else. I don't have brothers. I have 5 older sisters. I've never been in the Boy Scouts. I've never been in the military. I've never been in a frat. I've never been in, you know, any kind of organization that was just all men. And it was like, that's what we were. And we were just allowed to just like be men. And it was, you know, and that's a very rare thing in today's society to have that kind of situation. And the interesting thing was that pre my tenure there and post my tenure there, they've had women on the crew, but for 2013, 2014 and 2015, there were no women on the crew. It was just guys. it was boys camp. I mean, you know, you're smoking cigars, you're drinking beer, you're telling dirty jokes, you know, you're working really, really hard. You know, you're hiking into woods, you're putting out fires, you're running chainsaws. It's gritty, it's sweaty, it's dirty, it's fun, it's a challenge. Everybody's breaking balls and cutting up, and it's like, it's just, you really learn to have a thick skin and to just have fun. And like, and to take it back to Northern Jaeger, no matter how bad it got on the fire line, because there was some real gnarly things that happened, I could always look back on the Northern Jaeger and say, it's never as bad as on the Northern Jaeger. That was the peak of the worst for me. Wow. Of the worst for me. So that being on the Northern Jaeger gave me a mental fortitude that I've been able to carry out throughout my entire life.
Well, you know, like you're saying, you look at both of those experiences and that bonding and the group of people who did it. And while there were, either before you and after you, women who were on it or on the Northern Jaeger, it was primarily a male thing. And in many, you know, it reminds me of so many industries. That's why Dirty Jobs has always been a program that I've loved, because you get to see the hard blue collar people who basically do the real work, whether it's in construction, whether it's in all those fields, and what it takes to be able to do that, you know, I mean, to survive mm-hmm. that, be able to, you know, and you got to be tough mentally, but you got to be tough physically for a lot of it. And like you said, I mean, these were young guys. So it always, because I come from a blue collar background, I worked in factories, I worked in the post office, mail handler at night, you know, and you have that bond with the people you work with, because you drink with them, you work with them, you know, it's you tell jokes, you know, you make fun of each other, and you basically get to know everything about each other. So there's something special about that, and that blue collar experience that you've had in those particular two jobs. And then you move on, like you say, you evolve. What does hand crew mean? You mentioned hand crew. Hand crew. And what does it do? Give us a little bit, like sure. when a fire happens, give us
sure,
a little
sure,
bit.
Sure. For those of you that don't know, I'll break it down like this. With firefighters, with wildland firefighters, there are smoke jumpers, and they're usually teams of around 6 to 8 guys, and they jump out of the planes. They jump out of planes into fires. And I consider them like the special forces of firefighting because, I mean, technically they are. I mean, that's a very, very high risk job. And I mean, you're parachuting out of a perfectly good plane into a forest fire. Like, what are you doing? And you don't have a lot of resources, and they can manage to put fires out, or at least do a good job of starting to stop it. Then you have hotshot crews. Hotshot crews are 20-person crews, 20-man crews, and you know they're the ones that go in and so firefighting. You know, maybe most people don't know this, but there's a lot of places that don't have road access. So you're going to have to be like, okay, you got to hike in 2, 3, 4, 5 miles through nasty terrain to then go to work and start putting the fire out. And, you know, in order to do that, it's, you know, it's, so you'd line out and so you have like hotshot crews that do that. And the hotshot crews, they can go anywhere in the continental U.S. and overseas if they need to, as well as we were one step below hotshots, simply because like we did the same assignments as hotshot crews, but at the time the Highlands 20 was Washington State DNR would not allow them to become a hotshot crew because they wanted to keep them in state. So in order to be a hotshot crew, you have to have, I might get this wrong because it's been a few years, but I believe you have to have like at least like two overhead that are, or at least one or two overhead that are hired year round. And even though there's no fires, they're just hired year round, and they would only hire like our overhead for 9 months. They wouldn't keep them on for a full 12. We technically were not a hotshot crew, but we all did the same assignments. We were still hiking in and, you know, miles and miles through nasty terrain to put out fire. So the way that it works is, when you hike in, you hike out, excuse me, you hike in and you line out, which means you're walking in a line. There's a line of us, and you, in the front, you have your saw team. And it's like your chainsaws and your swampers. And then behind them, you're going to have Pulaskis, which is a type of tool. And then behind the Pulaskis, you're going to have like rhinos, which is another type of tool. And what you do is you go either, it depends on your tactics of fighting the fire, whether you're going to fight it direct or indirect. But let's just say you're going to fight it direct, which means you're going to like go to the fire line. So you are on the fire. And there are safety precautions, like you're not going to fires that are like, you know, if there's trees burning, you're not going to put that out. I mean, you as a crew are not going to do anything about that. But it's like there's a flame lengths that have to be like observed and everything. And if it's safe for you to go in there, you go to the fire line, and you are cutting Your chainsaws are coming through and they're cutting away all the either burning and or potential things that could burn. And they're cutting a swath, a path of about probably 8 to 10 feet swath, like on next to the fire line. And then coming behind them, they're called swampers, and they work with the saws. And anything that's burnt or anything that's cut, I should say, they're either throwing into the fire or they're throwing away from the fire into the green. And then coming behind them are the Pulaskis, and their Pulaskis are coming up, and they're chopping at the earth and they're breaking the earth. And then coming behind them are your other tools, and they're digging down and digging down. And like the end goal is to get down to bare mineral soil, an 18-inch wide line, fire line. And believe it or not, that does stop fires. It wow. seems like it seems like, I mean, yeah, of course you can have wind shifts and things can roll over and anything can happen, but it generally that does stop the fire is when you do that.
And obviously for all of us, myself included, who've never been on a fire line or anywhere near a fire that close, the danger for all the people who are on the fire, doing the fire line, and whether they from the special forces will dive into you guys all the way down, every one of you is risking life, risking injury, risking all kinds of things. So it's another, it takes a lot, takes courage. It takes a certain drive, and it takes a unique group of people to do it, you know. And once again, we get the outcome of that group risking that for us, makes us safer, makes us, you know, the people who, wherever you're living, that are in face of that. So that's just amazing. I just want people to like just know. And then, you know, your story, you know, we could just stop here, but then it doesn't stop here because you then go on another freaking journey. And,
Before I jump into that, I do want to touch back on the book State of Fire and say that, like, it was really important for me to write that book. Northern Jaeger was a passion project, but State of Fire was really, really important for me to write because I feel like most people, yes, they know about fires. Yes, they know they get put out. They don't know. I've read quite a few fire books, and typically they fall into like one or two categories. Either they're written by investigative journalists who do their best to describe what it's like. Like I read a book by Sebastian Younger called Fire, and great book. And he does a really good job of like trying his best to like describe things and like being in the moment, but it's not a true boots on the ground perspective. Mm. And the other category are firefighters that have written books that are just a complete ego stroke, where they're always just flawless and they're always the hero, and like it's like that's not how it is. That's not my experience,
right?
And so I really wanted to like show people like what it takes mentally, emotionally, physically, the toll that it takes on your love life, and you know, all the behind the scenes shenanigans and pranks that happen along the way. Because in my experience, firefighting was about 70% humorous and 30% dangerous. Mm. And so I really tried to reflect that in my book because there's a lot of shenanigans that happen, but it's also, there's a time for laughs and there's a time to get serious. That's why it was really important for me to write that book. And that book, State of Fire, came out of me in 9 months. Like it flew out of me. And it was my first book, and it just like, it flew out of me.
Well, I recommend both books to the audience for all kinds of things because it has all. It has the danger, it has the humor, it has the grittiness, it has the camaraderie. It shares all of it. And if you've never been in any of those kind of worlds like I haven't, this will put you there. It'll take you there. You'll get to see what it was like, and it's powerful and it's fun writing. And so I recommend you can go to stcharliespress.com where you can get both books, Northern Jaeger and the other one as well. So let me go back to where we were. Now I got a few more minutes to take you on your final 4-year adventure.
Sure.
Tell us about that and what you did, where you went, and what you accomplished on that.
Yeah. So in 2010, I'll start at the beginning a little bit. So in 2010, I was living in Los Angeles, and I'd been living in Los Angeles for about 8 years at that point. And I guess maybe about a year and a half before, maybe a late 2000 or mid 2009, 2008, to, you know, mid 2008, I just had a real existential crisis. And I realized that, like, I lived in a box, I worked in a box, I went to a gym in a box, and I was working 6 days a week, and I wasn't okay with that. I was like, this is, my life is not meant to be lived in boxes. And so that's what prompted me to take all these writing classes, because I knew in my heart of hearts I wanted to be a writer. And I saved money, and I came to the decision that I was going to go travel, because I come from a family of nomads. My parents have lived all overseas and all over the world. And so I was like, you know, I want that for myself. And so in 2010, I had saved up enough money, and that's why I left the writing class, and I split, and I left the States, and I went to Asia, and I traveled through Asia for 2 years. Only thing stopping me from staying there was I got dengue fever and almost died.
Wow.
And then I came back, didn't know what to do with myself. So I started going to university, started fighting fire. And as I'm taking my university courses, I'm like slowly kind of like figuring out what I want to do with my life and what kind of degree I want to get. And originally I was going to get a degree in international business or international relations. And then I was going to get a teaching degree. And then I landed on a creative writing degree because I was like, well, this is my passion. I should probably do this. And then as I was, you know, taking these courses and taking these classes and going to school, I was like, well, what do I want to do when I'm done? And I just have a love for travel and a love for being overseas. And I found this YouTube channel called Ninja Teacher. And it was, I think he was from South Africa. It was a South African guy that was teaching English in Vietnam. And I just like ate up his videos. I had never been to Vietnam in my travels. I had traveled all over Asia, but I had never been to, the two I had somehow missed were Vietnam and Cambodia. I just never made it to those two. And so this guy was just really selling me on teaching English in Vietnam. And I was like, that's it. And I can distinctly remember like looking out my apartment window, and it's just snowing like crazy. And it's just like, you know, just this blizzard happening outside, and I'm inside in my little apartment, and I'm watching this guy in Vietnam, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do that. That's me. I'm going to do that. And I told my friends, told everybody. And, yeah, my girlfriend at the time was the last person to know. She was not too pleased, but I was like, well, I don't really care. Like, I have to do this. Like, if I don't do this, I'm going to regret it. Like, this is far more important to me than our relationship. Which, you know, didn't make her happy, but, you know, I don't regret it. It doesn't matter. I graduated in university in December of 2016. And I was on a plane March 3rd of 2017, and I flew into Saigon, and I took a 1 month long TEFL course, teaching English in a foreign language, I guess is what it stands for. And I took that 1 month course, got certified. And the reason I chose Vietnam as opposed to anywhere else was because in 2015, they made a mandate across the country that they wanted to raise their English levels to a certain standard, and so they were paying more than anyone else, because typically, if you're teaching English abroad, like, you make enough to live on barely, and that's it. But I was making enough to like save money, which was like unheard of, and live a really great lifestyle. And I took that 1 month course. And then after that course, like my other friends were going on little vacations and stuff, and like I wasn't. I was grinding. I didn't have any money. I had to make money. I had to survive. So and thankfully it was very, very easy to get a job over there. I applied to, I think, 8 schools in a week, and I got 5 interviews, and I ended up teaching at a place called Apex English. And it was phenomenal. It was,
We're going to need to go do a show about your experience in Vietnam and the culture and your experience to go there.
Yeah.
But you know, there's so much to, you know, even dive into that. But in wrapping up, you know, I know you have some future plans, another book, filmmaking, directing and screenwriting. So kind of wrap up the show where you're going,
sure.
And wrap it up for us.
So my
Vietnam.
You bet. My next book is going to be about, it's either going to be one or two books. I'm still kind of figuring that out, but it's either going to be a book about my travels or a book about, teaching English in Vietnam or a combination of the two. It might be a combination of the two. We'll see. That's what I'm currently working on. And then, in the meantime, I really needed a break from nonfiction after I finished Northern Jaeger. So I wrote a horror comedy screenplay, because I've always been interested in film. And I was really inspired by, I really just kind of, I've been really inspired by a lot of low budget 80s trashy horror movies that, you know, they really are near and dear to me. I kind of grew up on them, and you know, my parents don't know I did that, but I would always, you know, sneak to the video store and, you know, watch these movies at midnight, you know. So I was really inspired by them, especially after I watched these documentaries of how they were made on just like shoestring budgets and like guerrilla filmmaking, like no permits. And I was just like, that really just inspired me. And so I wrote this screenplay. I've always had ideas kicking around in my head, and this one, last summer I wrote the screenplay, and I could definitely do a few more drafts on it, but I'll probably put that down and focus solely on my next book, and then I'll come back to that screenplay. But eventually the goal is to direct a movie, because I'll tell you this quick little bit. After my book launch on the 24th, I came home and I was just kind of like riding this high of just like, I don't even know how to explain it, just like the high of like releasing my book and like doing the launch, and it was just like really, really well. And you know, I'm laying in bed, and you know, the first thing that comes in my head is, what's next? What's the next challenge? What's the next challenge? And, you know, I thought, you know, and I've read quite a few books about, biographies about, you know, filmmaking. And, I'm like, now that's a challenge, because it's not just me having to deal with me. It's about, I mean, as you know, you have to deal with a lot of different people, a lot of different personalities.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, it tried to try to like make a vision, you know, come to focus. And so, that's what I ultimately want to do. I'm going to throw my hat in the ring and at least give it a shot. So
well, I'm sure you will, given all the things you've done so far. I'm pretty confident that you're going to pull it off. I mean, it's kind of amazing. We've crossed so many parallel paths, from, you know, blue collar backgrounds, your rural, me urban, but you know, to different adventures that we've gone on, and then in the memoir group, and then, you know, film, me doing film, and all these adventures. And I like what you just said. I think it's a good way to sum it up. And it's a good question for people to ask themselves on a regular basis. And that's, what's next? What's next? You know, because sometimes you get caught up in just that comfort zone, and you get caught up in that box, and you got to ask yourself, what's next? And take yourself out of that and go on another adventure, go on another journey, go on, you know, do something that you wanted to do, but you were afraid of, or you don't know how to do it. Do it anyway. Find a way to get there, like you did. You know what I mean? So that's why I know what you've accomplished so far with these books and with your adventures, I have no doubt about it. Your movies, it's there. It's just when. So
exactly. Yeah.
Charles, it's been a pleasure. I'm so glad that, you know, that we had this connection from the class to today and to, you know, to be able to join this journey together with you. Anything you want to close on? And once again, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. I just want to tell people that you can get copies of both my books, State of Fire and Northern Jaeger, at stcharliespress.com. Or you can also look them up on Amazon, either way. So that's my last 2 cents. And thank you, John. I really appreciate it. And I really hope this one, it makes it. We don't got to do a take five.
I think we got it right. I think we finally made it, man. Charles, thank you so much. And I look for, we'll come back on a story on Vietnam. That'll be the next one. But thank you once again. And I'm going to close out the show. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, John.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. I hope you were inspired by Charles Fott's story, his adventures, his courage, his inspiration to go on these journeys that he's gone on, and to inspire you to go on the journeys that you want to go on and that you should go on, and ask yourself that question like he did, what's next? So, you know, what's next? I hope that you stay and check out these programs in the future. And if you haven't seen the previous 79 podcasts with some of my amazing courageous friends, you can check them out on YouTube, the Live Courageously channel, or you can check them out on my website, which is live-courageously.com. And so until next Sunday, I hope you join us and you check out these different podcasts. And you go on your courageous and adventurous journey. So thanks for joining us. Have a great evening and God bless.